Welcome to ReAlliance Radio. ReAlliance is a network of regenerative practitioners and people working in the humanitarian and development sectors. At ReAlliance, we ask the question, how can we create long-term resilience even in times of crisis? And I have the very, very great pleasure to be here today with Rosemary Morrow, author of the book, The Earth User's Guide to Permaculture, now called The Earth Restorer's Guide to Permaculture. So it's wonderful to be here with you, Ro. Thank you so much for joining us again.
James, I really enjoyed being on this program, so thank you for asking me.
Well, it's our absolute pleasure. Lovely. And in fact, you were one of our first ReAlliance Radio guests, so it's such a pleasure to have you back. And in fact, I remember when we were speaking last time, you were telling us about how you are kind of rewriting and re-editing the Earth User's Guide to Permaculture. So it's amazing now that we're speaking and the revised edition is out.
Yes, you know, James, it was a service and a discipline more than inspiration and love. And it didn't come consciously. It must have been what I'd known needed to be done for years and years and years. And it was all there and I had to assemble it and edit it. But actually, it must have been thoughts of mine and experiences of mine for a long, long time about making permaculture more global and getting rid of that title.
So what was the motivation for you for changing from Earth Users to Earth Restorers Guide?
Well, it's a secret, James, but I always wanted right from the beginning. And the book went to Düsseldorf Book Fair, and all the people there voted for Earth Users, so the publishers wouldn't change at that time. But this time, I had a bit of a battle, and it's been accepted as Earth Restorers. And one of the strengths was this is a decade of ecosystem restoration. And because permaculture deals with ecosystems, I knew that this was the way to go and we could get it there. So that was one thing. It's the time. The second thing is I know of nothing else which combines as many different variables and systems and disciplines which can help people, individuals and groups to go for restoration in a big way, whether you look at things like biodynamics, regenerative farming, sustainable cities, they're all somewhat compartmentalized. And so what I wanted was something which integrated all those. And I had this insight after 40 years of doing permaculture, slow coming insight, that restoration is what permaculture does. It's not going into new lands and cutting them and destroying them, not going into forests or even deserts. It's restoration. And that, I think, makes permaculture easier to define than it's ever been. And then the UN endorsed it. They read the whole book while it was in manuscript form and said, yes, we like it. And so I got the endorsement for the decade of ecosystem restoration. And it all seemed seamless and right and comfortable at that time.
Fantastic. And well done on getting the approval of the UN. And I can even see on the back, I have the book right here in my hands, the logo of the United Nations Decade on Ecosystem Restoration. So it's fantastic. And not that you want my opinion on the book, but I hope you don't mind if I give it. You use the term integrated and how permaculture is an integrated approach to restoration. And something that I loved about this book, and I think it's such a fantastic book, I love that it seems so integrated and you could open to any page and be inspired by, you know, how we can engage with the living systems around us.
Thanks, James. Yes, all these variables being integrated makes permaculture unique and different, but how do you define it? A design system for integrating livelihood. It doesn't ever sound good. If we talk about as ecosystem restoration, whether it's cultivated ecosystems or natural ecosystems, it matches. And I had already taken an ecosystem focus. So recently when someone said to me, what's your favourite tree? I said, I don't think in trees, I think in ecosystems. I think of the tree and everything around it naturally. So we need to think in ecosystems, not in individual species. And that way we can say things like biodiversity, soils and water, habitat.
You mentioned earlier that one of your motivations for re-exploring the book was to create a more global focus. And you can really see that looking at the book. You mentioned permaculture applied to humanitarian settings and in the global south. What was your motivation to include this?
Well, I think you know, James, but for years I've been working in situations of post-war and civil war. And I had always, you know, trimmed and sculptured my work to be right for those people. But it was in the refugee camps I suddenly thought, goodness, the land, piece of land and the backyard and the lemon tree and the circular path has no application here whatsoever. What has application is growing food for the kitchen, and how do we do that? What has application is cleaning water, and how do we do it? And then when you look at the figures, the number of people who have a sixth of an acre, quarter of an acre, quarter of a hectare, tenth of a hectare is tiny today. You know, we're getting 70% of the world living in cities, in towers, buildings, and we've got forcibly displaced people living in tents and containers. Where is permaculture for these? And I realized that permaculture really had to, it wasn't universal, it wasn't global, it was tending to be, well, European middle class, European culture middle class, and very, very good for them. But they are a minority world and will continue to become less, more of a minority than they presently are. And the numbers without access to land as permaculture started with its own one's own two's own had to be changed to have relevance. And so that was what I was doing in the camps. And then when I came back, it was ready to go because I've been experimenting.
And I sense that this will only continue to be more and more relevant as time goes on. I mean, we were chatting just before we started recording this podcast about some of the degradation that you've noticed even in your home place in so-called Australia. Can you tell us a bit about what you're noticing from how the world is changing?
In the 1970s with the Club of Rome and then Mollison and Holmgren and permaculture, I totally believed what they were saying. They were talking about CO2 increasing, climate change, but I didn't think it would happen in my lifetime. I didn't think we were going to run into the extremes we have now. So the most extraordinary thing is to watch landscapes change in geological time in my lifetime. So where you would expect things like water-formed landscape, these huge floods in Pakistan and Australia are changing the course of rivers, changing the shapes of mountains, changing the deposition of soil, changing plant and weed populations as they carry it, and so are the fires. And suddenly I feel as if I'm sped up over tens of thousands of years to watch the whole earth change, and that and the degradation I've seen are really quite shocking because it seemed a long way away and now it's here and we're not ready for it. And most people, I think, are not seeing it even. Just here where I am in Portugal now, knowing what it would have been a few hundred years ago and what it is now and what the drought's done to it. It's gone from being probably open woodland to semi-arid. Just in 20 years, this is geological time. And we're going to watch glaciers melt and they'll be unstoppable. So what we're faced with at the moment is the whole world changing shape speedily due to all sorts of global warming and its impacts on the land. And I can't quite get used to it. It's so huge and so extraordinary.
At the time of recording this, over the past few weeks, we've had even more UN reports which say exactly what you're saying, that we are in unprecedented times of ecological and geological change, like you say, and how it affects, you know, our social landscapes as well in such a monumentous way. With all of these intense global changes, may I ask what gives you hope?
I think being part of the solution, it's always better to have something really good to do or to talk about or to tell people or to put your mind. And I think it would be morally aberrant not to try to be part of the solution. I think people like myself probably lived perhaps in the best of the world. We've had scholarships and privilege and schooling and education. And I think it's a little bit like yoga talks, as yoga speaks about. It's time to give back. It's time to put back anything. You know, select carefully, because you don't want to mislead people. It has to be accurate, true, and relevant. But from that, we have to use our knowledge and reflection and experience put together to come up with something that could be useful in the present. And I'm hoping the book will be good for at least 10 years. I hope, if things don't speed up too fast.
The book, you could open to any chapter and be so blown away by, like you say, the practical solutions that we could implement. What did you add to the book? What's new in this edition?
Well, James, I rewrote the whole book.
Oh, wow.
Every chapter was started and gone through really from a new place. I changed the order of the book and I added new chapters. In the last book, there was a little bit about patterns in nature, which sort of, it was a type of feel-good chapter. You know, there's this pattern and that pattern, and isn't it all lovely? This time, and I'd love to get your comments on it, I was trying to come to terms with how reading patterns and pattern literacy leads you into really good analysis of a landscape. So I can look at this and know, as it's deteriorating, it was open woodland, and I can see where it's going. Therefore, I could know what to try to restore to. It wouldn't be perfect, but if they got a sense of urgency and started now, they'd be aiming for that earlier pork, cork, pigs, the seven layers of the Mediterranean oaks that were here that restored the soils, and they'd be well on the way. And there are regenerative patches everywhere. And if the country had a sense of urgency, they would demand that those patches were enlarged, studied, grown, and try to recover the land within 20 years with what was here maybe 500 years ago, but certainly a few hundred years ago. So looking at things such as orders, which is magnitude and stability of a landscape, that's the river. How stable is it? How stable is that landscape? How stable is the hill? How stable is the ecosystem? Understanding and knowing when to intervene. And I don't think I'd done that before. I hadn't made it. I hope it's clear. It may only be clear to permaculturists. But getting to put yourself in a time and place where you know what to do and how to do it. So those patterns are all around that. For people who want to learn the mathematical relationships to a form, it's there. But for the others, really worked on talking about the circle as a pattern for dry lands to re-establish. Small perimeter, maximum space, density for water, for everything, and many circular patches in restoration. So much better than trying to do other things if the land's degraded. So approaching the patterns in nature and the forms in nature, not from a gee whiz nature wonderful, but much more how it can be a very good tool to know where you are and what's needed.
And this this framing of how to inspire ecological literacy in people, and like you say, you lay it out in some very direct ways which are fantastic for readers. Why is it so important to teach people how to read the landscapes around them?
I hope it's not just me, but the sense is over the last 20, 30 years, people are retreating from landscapes. They might like a bushwalk or go skiing in winter or paddle a canoe down a river, but I really think they've lost their literacy on the whole. Working with the Rohingya, when I said to them, please restore your trees and their uses, I think they listed more than 100 trees, and I don't know how many uses of those trees. If I asked Australians to list all the eucalypts and all the uses, they'd give me firewood, eucalyptus oil, probably. Probably, that would be it. So they're illiterate in understanding the landscape, and I think most people are. And the CONSO in Southwest Africa, a tribe up a couple of thousand meters, they could name, I think, 972 of the 974 species, knowing where they lived and how they lived and what the uses were. Doesn't mean the landscape's used as we use things functionally all the time. It means that they understood where and how and what grew and when. And they were highly literate. And that's not valued anymore. And it's time we went back to understanding where we are and what we're seeing on a bigger basis, I think.
How does that apply to people who may move and who may go from living in one landscape to another, for example, people who are displaced?
Well, there are two things. First of all, people who are displaced very often have wonderful knowledge. So I found the Syrians had grown the most wonderful farms in Syria for generations and generations and generations. And they were able to describe in great detail the integrated nature of a family farm, which is largely lost in Europe. It's bigger. People have been asked not to farm anymore, all sorts of things like that. And then there are people like the Rohingya who have lived in the forest, the Khomsa lived on the tops of mountains and steep slopes, the Abu in Bali on the east coast, not well known, the first Balinese, and they live without cutting trees. So they go to the forest and pick the mangoes and pick the jackfruit and pick the thing, but they don't cut trees. And they've been able to teach the others how to grow the landscape back where it was all flooding. That means one thing is that people in these situations, often the most vulnerable, climate justice, they get run out first for war or famine or whatever. And when they go, they're taking a lot of knowledge. They were the ones who most appreciate permaculture. They loved it. They'd sort of, although the species were different, maybe the combinations were different, they'd say, this is what we do. And it sort of was. It was right. Growing food, putting it together, being proud of being a farmer, being proud of growing food, regarding people highly who could look after the environment. And we don't have any of that esteem for people who can do that, and neither do we have the knowledge. So not everyone has the knowledge, but a lot of people have the knowledge. I think the Afghans who have been displaced now for nearly 40 years and been in war, these young ones don't have the knowledge, but they're keen to get it. And they want to, those who are refugees want to send it back to Afghanistan. So there is the knowledge, and it's no use us taking their knowledge, it's us taking their principles and learning how to do it in our own environments. And then they can create environments, even in these very dense populations. All the black water channels and filths and water running away, all that can be turned into greenery and water filtering. Every bare space can be turned into a tree for shade. So there are immense possibilities, even when people are crowded, and they use them. They're happy to have them. Suddenly they see, and then they go and do it, and then it's no stopping, really.
Something that really sung to me last time we spoke was how you mentioned this, and when you work with people to create spaces of learning, when you teach them or when you facilitate learning with people, it's your focus is on drawing out the inherent wisdom and the traditional wisdom that is really rich in people. And I remember you said that you sometimes don't even use the term permaculture.
Actually, I tend to use the word permaculture now because it is something we must be proud of. And the fact that for a while it was seen as if hippies or someone did it, I think was a great disservice to permaculture. May have been because we didn't have a decent definition that people could quickly understand and grasp what it was. And it's difficult because it covers so many fields. But I fill the gaps. So people in the camps may never have had a solar panel. So you can introduce the idea of car batteries from Iran. In Iraq, you can do that. And small solar panels. You can introduce ways to filter and clean water, which are really effective and give people biomass. You can show the possibilities when you have vertical land instead of flat land, how they can grow in pots and plastic things and hang things by string from the roof. So they will take it from there. So it's understanding where the gaps are in the principles, and then they do it all. Yeah, because they know. they suddenly go, oh, of course we could do that, almost if they thought, of course, yes, and they're away. Yeah. So that's a whole chapter in the book, and it's called Permaculture on the Edges. And I'm a bit self-conscious about it because people don't feel they're on the edges. Every person's the centre of the world. But so far as global prejudice and inability to deal well with people seeking security, they are on the edge. But in their own lives, they're not. And there are wonderful things. You can provide water, you can provide schools, you can provide playgrounds, you can provide women's groups. You can do all the social stuff, help them get a bazaar going, encourage people to keep the money in that camp or community and not let it get out where there is any, and even earn a small income. So there's a lot that can be done from permaculture very easily, and people want it. And they're usually much quicker than Westerners who say, I don't know, and I'll think about it, and what if? And they say, yes, okay, we'll try. And it's quite wonderful, of course.
May I ask, what would be your greatest hope for the book?
Well, the word was not fun. The book itself is not fun and inspiration. I had a sense it was enormously important at this stage to provide a new vision of permaculture. Had to be integrated with the UN SDGs, it had to serve all people, had to take enough traditional knowledge and skills to account for ocean rising, as I did in Bangladesh, Masa Arabs, those countries whose oceans are rising very fast. It had to deal with dry land sea systems from the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, where they had traditional water collection far better than ours, much infinitely better. And people might need access to it. My hope for the book when I wrote it was it fulfills a need. And that kept me going. There were times when you wonder, what am I doing this for? It's 512 pages. It's a doorstop, James. It'll keep the door open in windy weather. You know, it's a big book. And ploughing on through that was a sense that I believe this is worthwhile and useful. And concentrating on design, concentrating on restoration. I suppose it's an intuitive sense. I mean, isn't intuition gathered from all our senses? All the senses and everything I've experienced intuitively. This is what I think is needed. And hope that someone else will take some of the chapters, like Care of the Oceans, and write the big book and the final book. But at the moment, let's start here. Get some zones out for oceans. Let's start understanding what we can do. Maritime permaculture was completely ignored, really, except a few fishermen in boats in Solomons or somewhere. And I think that conviction that it needed, and someone else will go further in time, it just needed to be out there in some usable form, at least now. That was it. Where will it go? I hope it goes everywhere. And the first translation, James, is going to be in Bangladeshi, one of the poorest countries of the world. And we got them some funding translated, and they hope to have it done by June and first 3,000 copies out. And, of course, it'll go into the language of the next province in India. And Taiwan are very interested in translating. I'd love it to get to people. But I would like to see it go where it's absolutely needed.
I just imagine, what if everybody who is working in the humanitarian sector read this book, the kind of change that could be implemented with these very practical but also very transformative solutions that you outline in here? Because like you mentioned, the focus on building people's ecological literacy, being able to read the not just the landscapes, but also the social scapes around them. And then the very, which really transforms people's minds as well as actions. In fact,
I have another dream, James, as a result of working in the refugee camps, and that is that every NGO worker working with refugees has a PDC. So that even if they come from the water sector, or they come from the education sector, or they come from building, or they come from health, they've all done permaculture and know how to integrate it. So instead of keeping this silo approach, don't tread on my patch, they're actually working together. And I think it will transform a refugee experience and refugee camps, especially when people are there a long time and there's no evidence they're going to be able to move quickly. And it's cheap. It's very, very cheap to do a refugee course with NGOs and then have them all working together in camps, compared with solutions like buying trees and putting them in and people pull them out and don't like them. It's very, very good. But they have to work together with the refugee population so that it's understood and known. So that's my dream. My dream would be that the UNHCR and the other big refugee organisations pick it all up and run with it so it's transformative there as much as anywhere else. That would be a dream.
And if anyone who is listening who could help to help this happen, whether through funding or through changing policies in humanitarian or development agencies, what would you tell them, Ro, as to why it's so important for people to do permaculture design certifications? What's in it for them?
Well, having worked in refugee camps, it can be completely demoralising and distressing and quite traumatising. And they're often working with fairly negative things, such, you know, World Food Programme brings the food, but you don't like the food and you're dispensing oil, tea, coffee and sugar, and you would rather be doing green vegetables, and you haven't got the knowledge and the skills to be able to supplement what's coming in with your knowledge. I think we'd get a real transformation from not exactly despair, but, you know, this system's awful, but I'm glad I'm here because it helps to have people like this, right through to, well, I know what to do and we can work together and we'll have a meeting and redesign the camp and then we'll start teaching the refugees. They can do their sectors. We'll just organise the supplies. But we have to have lots of PDC teachers for that. Good teachers, teachers who know how to work in these environments, not teachers who teach to maybe a PDC in Sydney or London or New York State. We have to have teachers who can teach differently. Not because refugees are unable to understand the most difficult concepts, but teachers have to be able to put difficult concepts into language that a translator can use if the translator has poor English and no knowledge of permaculture. So at that point, you have to understand how the language gets transformed into something useful and change teaching methods.
For teachers who may be listening, permaculture teachers, what was your journey with helping to understand how language changes in this context?
Yeah, pretty much experience, Jane. I don't use a word without giving an example. So we'll be going to the summit of the hill. We're going to the top of the hill. And I would use that sentence, both, right? And the aspect is northeast. The slope and direction of the sun is towards the northeast. So let's go and look. So that is actually more for the translator than the refugees, who often know all this stuff. But the translator has to have it easily, and models and role plays all the time for misinformation that might be going through. Yeah, I think the book would help them. And then I think there's a need to rethink the teaching, so that everything is clear and enabled and not blocked. You know, the first permaculture I did, the teachers just talk for 72 hours, which is pretty good, isn't it? I mean, 72 hours talking is quite a big thing to do, but still people went to sleep and woke up and went outside and, you know, came back and had a cup of coffee down the road and came back with an apple pie. And it was all a bit not care of people, which would be creating a learning situation in which they could thrive. So that was a big change for me, enabling learners to participate as much as possible.
Thank you again for this fantastic book, which is so rich and I think can be so transformative for people. And I encourage anyone listening to check it out, The Earth Restorer's Guide to Permaculture, the latest edition of Rosemary Morrow's book. And people can look on the Meliodora website, I guess.
Yes. Yes, that's the one. And if you buy bulk, it's nearly half price. That's a secret. If you buy 10 copies, it's about $33 Australian. If you buy one, it's $73. Get the bulk and let your friends all benefit. That's a secret for everyone to hear. I would love to mention Rob's work. Rob's work, the drawings are beautiful, I think.
The illustrations.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And they're made so that if you remove the captions, you can remove the captions and just add it in a translation. You don't have to translate the captions. You can just write the caption. And the other thing is it blows up into A1 posters and looks absolutely beautiful. So if you take the water cycle and blow that up, you can have it on the wall right through a course, and you can refer to all the different landscapes and what's happening with water and what could be done. And it's really marvelous. And it blows up without distortion. So Rob did a fabulous job.
It just makes the book very accessible, I think, to be able to see in such gorgeous pictures what you're explaining. So, yeah fantastic
people,
work to Rob
people
too.
Say, I remember page 83. I say, what did I write? No, they say the drawing. Isn't that gorgeous? I love that. Beautiful.
That's great.
So it's been a joy, and really Adora have been very, very cooperative, because at first they just wanted me to add a few sentences and I rewrote everything. And they kept saying, it's getting bigger and bigger. And I said, yes, this is a book I want to write. And I think they had many conferences down there in Melbourne about Victoria, about how it was going. But I think they're pleased.
Great. They must have got a big shock when you said, I want to rewrite the whole thing.
Right, yes. They kept saying, no, just a little bit at the end. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. And they were they adapted beautifully. And I think they're very glad.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, it's an amazing book. And I really hope everybody can take your advice and get them in bulk, hand them out to all your friends and family, and create some fantastic change. So thank you so much, Ro, for this great conversation. It's been such a pleasure chatting to you again, and thank you for being part of this.
Thanks for a great interview. I feel as if we're sitting in your living room having a chat.
Oh, thank you. Well, I hope we can do that someday as well. Maybe that will be episode 3 of our conversation.
Thank you, James, and thanks to ReAlliance. And I hope people look up the ReAlliance website, because there's some really good things.
Thank you so much.